realized what they were all staring at. It was like an optical illusion. Once you understood what your eyes were seeing, you could never again see the image otherwise. In that paused frame, the camera had caught Kelly Wilson holding the revolver, just as she had confessed to Sam, but as with a lot of Kelly Wilson's statements, there was more to the story. Kelly had worn black that day. Judith Pinkman had worn red. Charlie remembered thinking how the woman's shirt was soaked through with Lucy Alexander's blood. The sepia tone of the recording had almost blended the two dark colors. But once Ben had finished on his laptop, the truth was there for all to see. The black-sleeved arm had a red-sleeved arm alongside it. Two arms pointing toward the classroom door. Two fingers wrapped around the trigger.
"The gun was in my hand."
Kelly Wilson had told Sam at least three times during the interview that she was holding the revolver when Douglas Pinkman and Lucy Alexander were murdered. What the girl had failed to mention was that Judith Pinkman's hand was holding it there. Charlie said, "They tested Kelly for gunshot residue at the hospital. It was on her hand, all over her shirt, exactly where you'd expect to find it." Judith sat back in her chair, her eyes stayed on her own hands. Charlie said, "The residue is like talcum powder, if that's what you're worried about. It washes off with soap and water."
"I know it does, Charlotte."
Her voice was scratchy, like the sound a record makes when the needle first hits the vinyl.
"I know it does."
Charlie waited. She could hear a clock ticking somewhere. She felt a slight breeze snaking out from the edges of the closed kitchen door. Judith finally looked up. Her eyes glistened in the overhead light. She studied Charlie for a moment, then asked,
"Why is it you? Why didn't the police come?"
Charlie did not realize that she was holding her breath until she felt the strain in her lungs.
"Do you want it to be the police?"
Judith looked up at the ceiling. Her tears began to fall.
"I guess it doesn't matter. Not anymore."
Charlie said, "She was pregnant."
"Again," Judith said. "She had an abortion in middle school."
Charlie braced herself for a polemic about the sanctity of life, but Judith did not offer one. Instead, the woman stood up. She pulled a paper towel from the roll. She wiped her face.
"The father was a boy on the football team. Several boys had their fun, apparently. She was naive. She had no idea what they were doing to her."
"Who was the father this time?"
"You're going to make me say it."
Charlie nodded. She was a recent convert to giving voice to the truth.
"Doug," she said. "He fucked her in my room."
Charlie must have reacted to the fuck because she said,
"I'm sorry for the language, but when you see your husband screwing a 17-year-old girl in the classroom where you teach middle schoolers, that's the first word that comes to mind."
17, Charlie repeated. Douglas Pinkman had been an administrator. Kelly Wilson was a student in the same school system. What he had done was commit statutory rape. Fucking had nothing to do with it. Judith said,
"That's why the camera was angled down. Doug was smart about it. He was always smart about it."
"There were other students?"
"Anything he could stick it into."
She balled the paper towel into her hand. She had become visibly angry. For the first time, Charlie was worried Sam and Ben had been right about how dangerous this could be. Charlie asked,
"That's why this happened? Because Kelly got pregnant?"
"It wasn't for the reason you're thinking."
"I'm sorry, Charlotte. You clearly wanted children, but I didn't. I never did. I love them. I love how their minds work. I love how funny and interesting they can be, but I love it more when I can leave them at school, come home and read a book and enjoy the silence. She tossed the paper towel into the trash can. I'm not some desperate woman who couldn't have a child, so she snapped. Not having a child was a choice. A choice I thought Doug agreed with, but... She shrugged. You never know how bad your marriage is until it's over. Charlie guessed. He wanted a divorce? Judith laughed bitterly. No, and I didn't want one either. I had learned to live with his perpetual midlife crisis. He wasn't a pedophile. He didn't go after the young ones. Charlie wondered at how easily the woman dismissed the fact that Kelly Wilson had the emotional intelligence of a child. Judith said, Doug wanted us to keep the baby. Kelly was going to drop out of school anyway. There was no way she could graduate. He wanted us to give her some money, make her go away, and raise the baby together. Of all the things Judith could have said, Charlie had never suspected this was what had finally broken her. What changed his mind about wanting a kid? Feeling his mortality? Wanting to leave a legacy? Just so damn arrogant and selfish and stupid? She huffed out an angry breath. I'm 56 years old. Doug was about to turn 60. We should be planning our retirement. I didn't want to raise some other woman's, some teenager's baby. She shook her head, clearly still furious. Not to mention Kelly's mental deficits. Doug wasn't just expecting me to raise a child for the next 18 years. He wanted us to be stuck with it for the rest of our lives. Any sympathy Charlie could have felt evaporated with those words. Judith asked, What else did Kelly tell you? She shook her head. It doesn't matter. I was going to play the martyr, the poor widow accused of being complicit by a cold-blooded simpleton. Who would believe her over me? Charlie said nothing, but she knew that, without the footage, no one would have believed the girl. So, Judith angrily wiped away her tears. Is this the part where I tell you how I did it? She pointed to Charlie's phone. Make sure it's still recording. Charlie turned over the phone, though she trusted that Ben had set it up properly. The phone was not only recording, it was transmitting the audio back to his laptop. Judith said, The affair started a year ago. I saw them through the window in my classroom. Doug thought I had left. He stayed to lock up. At least, that's what he said. I went back for some papers. As I said, he was screwing her on one of the desks. Charlie pressed her back to the chair. Judith seemed to be getting angrier with each word. So, I did what any obedient wife would do. I turned around. I went home. I prepared dinner. Doug came home. He told me he got hung up with a parent. We watched TV together and I seethed. I seethed all night. When did you start tutoring Kelly? When she started dressing like a witch again. Judith braced the heels of her hands on the counter. That's what she did the last time. She started wearing black, like the goths, to hide her belly. I knew the moment I saw her in the hall that she was pregnant again. Did you confront Doug? Why would I do that? I'm just the wife. I'm just the woman who cooks his meals and irons his clothes and bleaches the stains out of his underwear. Her voice had a grinding undertone, like a clock being overwound. Do you know what it's like to not matter? To live in the same house with a man for almost your entire adult life and feel like you're nothing? That your wishes, your desires, your plans are irrelevant? That any burden, no matter how great, can be thrown at you, and because you're a good woman, a God-fearing Christian woman, and you'll just take it with a smile because your husband, the man who is supposed to be your protector, is the master of the house? Judith had clasped her hands together so hard that the knuckles were white. She told Charlie, "Of course you don't. You've been coddled. You've been cherished all of your life. Even losing your mother, your sister almost dying, your father being reviled by everyone in the state, made people love you more." Charlie's heart pounded in her throat. She did not realize that she had stood up from the chair until she felt her back against the wall. Judith didn't seem to notice the effect she was having. "You can talk Kelly into anything. Did you know that?" Charlie did not move. "She's so sweet and fragile and tiny. She's like a child. She really is. But the more time I spent with her, the more I hated her." She shook her head. Her hair was coming unpinned. Her eyes had a wild look. "Do you know how that feels? To hate an innocent kid? To focus all of your rage on someone who doesn't know what they're doing, what's happening to them, because you realize that you can see your own stupidity reflected in their behavior? That you see how your husband controls them, cheats on them, uses them, abuses them the same way that he does with you?" Charlie scanned the room. She saw the knives in the wooden block, the drawers full of utensils, the cabinet that likely still had Mr. Heller's rifle on top. "I'm sorry," Judith said, visibly working to calm herself. She followed Charlie's gaze to the top of the cabinet. "I thought I was going to have to make up a story about how Kelly had stolen it, or give her the money and pray that she could follow the instructions to buy one." Charlie said, "Her dad kept a revolver in his car. She told me he used it to shoot squirrels. Hala people eat them sometimes." "It's greasy," Charlie said, trying to keep her calm. "I have a client who cooks it in stew." Judith gripped the back of the chair. Her knuckles were white. "I'm not going to hurt you," Charlie forced out a laugh. "Isn't that what people say before they hurt someone?" Judith pushed away from the chair. She leaned against the counter again. She was still angry, but she kept working to control it. "I shouldn't have said that about your tragedy. I apologize." "It's all right. You're saying that because you want me to keep talking." Charlie shrugged her shoulder. "Is it working?" Her laugh was filled with disgust. Ben had said that Judith Pinkman had been hysterical when the paramedics had taken her out the middle school doors. They'd had to sedate her to get her into the ambulance. She had stayed at the hospital all night. She had gone on camera to plead for Kelly's life. Even now, her eyes were swollen from crying. Her face was haggard with grief. She was telling Charlie the truth, the brutal, unvarnished truth, though she knew that she was being recorded. She wasn't bargaining. She wasn't pleading. She wasn't trying to make some kind of trade. This was how a person behaved when they felt true remorse for their actions. Judith said, "Kelly wouldn't pull the trigger on her own. She promised me that she would, but I knew that she wasn't like that. She was too kind, and she was too trusting, and she would have been a horrible shot. So I stood behind her in the hall, and I wrapped my hand around hers, and I fired a shot into the wall to get Doug's attention." She tapped her fingers to her mouth, as if to remind her voice to stay calm. He came running out, and I shot him 3 times, and then...
Charlie waited. Judith pressed her hand to her chest. Her anger had gone completely cold. She admitted,
I was going to kill Kelly. That was the plan. Shoot Doug, then murder Kelly, and say that I stopped her from slaughtering more children. Town hero. I'd get Doug's pension, his social security, no messy divorce. More time to read my books, right?
Charlie wondered if she had planned on shooting Kelly in the stomach to make sure her baby was dead, too.
Judith said, I managed to hit Doug in all the right places. The coroner told me that any one of the 3 shots was fatal. I guess he thought that would be a comfort.
Her eyes glistened again. She swallowed, her throat making an audible sound.
But Kelly wouldn't let go of the gun. I don't think she knew the rest of the plan, that I was going to kill her. I think she panicked when she saw that Doug was dead.
We struggled. The trigger was pulled. I don't know if it was me or her, but the bullet ricocheted into the floor.
Judith breathed through her mouth. Her voice was raspy. She continued,
We were both shocked that the gun had gone off. And Kelly turned, and I don't know.
I don't know what happened. I panicked. I saw movement out of the corner of my eye, and I pulled the trigger again, and...
She was cut off by a whimper. Her lips had turned white. She was trembling.
I saw her. I saw her when... While my finger pulled the trigger. It happened so slowly, and my brain recognized it. I remember thinking, Judith, you're shooting a child. But I couldn't stop it. My finger kept pulling back, and...
She could not say the words, so Charlie did. Lucy Alexander was shot. Judith's tears flowed like water.
A team teach with her mother. I used to see Lucy at meetings, dancing around in the back of the room. She would sing to herself. She had such a sweet voice. I don't know. Maybe it would have been different if I hadn't known her, but I knew her.
Charlie could not help but think that the woman had known Kelly Wilson, too. Judith said,
Charlotte, I'm so sorry that I made you a part of this. I had no idea you were in the building. I would have done it the next day or next week. I never would have knowingly put you in that situation.
Charlie was not going to thank her.
I wish I could explain what came over me. I thought that Doug and I were... I don't know. He wasn't the great love of my life, but I thought that we cared for each other, respected each other. But after that many years, everything is entangled. You'll see when you get there. Finances, retirement, benefits, cars, this house, savings accounts, tickets we bought for a cruise this summer.
Money, Charlie said. Rusty had thousands of quotes about man's destructive desires for sex and money.
It wasn't just the money, Judith said. When I confronted Doug about the pregnancy and he presented his brilliant plan for us to become geriatric parents, like it was nothing to take on that kind of commitment, and it wasn't, not for him. He wasn't going to be the one getting up at 3 in the morning to change diapers.
I know. It seems incredible that that was what finally did it, but it was the last straw.
She searched Charlie's eyes as if she expected agreement. Judith said,
I let myself hate Kelly because that was the only way I could talk myself into doing it. I knew that she was pliable. All I had to do was whisper in her ear,
Wasn't she a bad girl for what she let Doug do to her? Wasn't she going to hell for what happened in middle school? Couldn't she punish Doug for his transgressions? Couldn't she stop him from hurting other girls? I was amazed by how little time it took to convince another human being that she was nothing, Judith repeated. Nothing. Just like me.
Charlie's hands were sweating. She wiped them on her dress. There's another verse you probably know, Charlotte. I'm sure you heard it in a movie or read it in a book. Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. The golden rule, Charlie said. Do unto others as they do unto you.
I did to Kelly what Doug did to me. That's what I told myself. That's how I justified my actions, and then I saw Lucy and I realized.
Judith held up her index finger, as if to start counting.
A proud look through the window of my room.
She held up another finger, listing her sins.
A lying tongue to my husband, to Kelly.
Another finger went up. Wicked imaginations about murdering both of them. Running toward evil when I put that gun in her hand. False witness to the police about what happened. Sowing discord to you, to Mason Huckabee, to the entire town.
She gave up counting and held up all of her fingers. Hands that shed innocent blood.
Judith stood there. Her hands in the air, palms out, fingers spread. Charlie did not know what to say.
What will happen to her?
Judith asked.
To Kelly.
Charlie shook her head, though she knew that Kelly Wilson would go to prison. Not to death row. Probably not for the rest of her life, but low IQ or not, the girl was right. The gun was in her hand. Judith said,
I need you to leave, Charlotte. I...
Take your phone. She tossed the phone to Charlie. Send the recording to that woman at the GBI. Tell her she can find me here. Charlie fumbled to catch the phone.
What are you...
Leave. Judith reached her hand up to the top of the cabinet. She didn't have her father's rifle. She had a Glock.
Jesus.
Charlie stumbled back.
Please leave.
Judith dropped the empty magazine from the gun.
I told you I'm not going to hurt you. What are you going to do?
Charlie's heart quivered as she asked the question. She knew what the woman was planning to do.
Charlotte, go.
Judith found a box of bullets and scattered them onto the table. She started to load the magazine.
Jesus,
Charlie repeated. Judith paused her work.
I know how ridiculous this is going to sound, but please stop taking the Lord's name in vain.
Okay, Charlie said. Ben was listening. He was probably on his way, running through the woods, jumping over trees, pushing limbs aside, trying to find Charlie. All she had to do was keep Judith talking.
Please, Charlie begged. Please don't do this. I have questions to ask you about that day, about what...
You need to forget about it, Charlotte. You need to do what your daddy told you and put it in a box and leave it there, because I am telling you right now that you don't ever want to remember what that horrible man did to you. Judith jammed the magazine into the gun.
Now, I really need for you to go. Oh, Judith... Please don't do this.
Charlie felt her voice shake.
This couldn't happen. Not in this kitchen. Not to this woman. Please.
Judith pulled back the slide, loading a bullet into the chamber.
Leave, Charlotte. I can't.
Charlie held out her hands, reaching toward Judith, toward the gun.
Please don't do this. This can't happen. I can't let you.
Bright white bone. Pieces of heart and lung. Cords of tendon and arteries and veins and life spilling out of her gaping wounds.
Judith!
Charlie cried.
Please!
Charlotte. Her voice was firm, like a teacher in front of the classroom. You are to go outside immediately. I want you to get in your truck and drive to your father's house and call the police.
Judith, no.
They're used to handling these sorts of things, Charlotte. I know that you think you are, but I can't take that on my conscience. I just can't.
Judith, please. I am begging you.
Charlie was so close to the gun. She could lunge for it. She was younger, faster. She could stop this. Don't. Judith placed the gun behind her on the counter. I told you that I'm not going to hurt you. Don't make me go back on my word.
I can't.
Charlie was sobbing. She felt like razors were pumping through her heart.
I can't leave you here to kill yourself.
Judith opened the kitchen door. You can, and you will.
Judith, please, don't put this burden on me.
I'm lifting your burden, Charlotte. Your father is gone. I'm the last person who knows. Your secret dies with me.
It doesn't need to die!
Charlie screamed.
I don't care! People already know! My husband, my sister, I don't care, Judith, please! Please don't!
Without warning, Judith charged toward her. She grabbed Charlie around the middle. Charlie felt her feet leave the ground. She braced her hands against the woman's shoulders. Her ribs felt crushed as she was carried across the kitchen and thrown out onto the porch.
Judith, no!
Charlie scrambled to stop her. The door slammed in her face. The lock clicked.
Judith!
Charlie yelled, banging her fist on the door.
Judith, open the...
She heard a loud crack echo inside the house. Not a car backfiring. Not fireworks. Charlie fell to her knees. She pressed her hand to the door. A person who has been up close when a gun is fired into another human being never mistakes the sound of a gunshot for something else. What happened to Sam? Sam alternated her arms in the water, cutting a narrow channel through the warm waters of the swimming pool. She turned her head every third stroke and drew in a long breath. Her feet fluttered. She waited for the next breath. Left, right, left, breathe. She performed a perfect flip turn against the wall of the pool, keeping her eyes on the black line guiding her lane. She had always loved the calmness, the simplicity of the freestyle stroke. That she had to concentrate just enough on swimming so that all extraneous thoughts floated away. Left, right, left, breathe. Sam saw the mark at the end of the line. She coasted until her fingers touched the wall. She kneeled on the floor of the pool, breathing heavily, checking her swimmer's watch. 2.4 kilometers at 154.2 seconds per 100 meters. So, 38.55 seconds per 25-meter length. Not bad. Not as good as yesterday. But she had to make peace with the fact that her body worked at its own speed. Sam tried to tell herself that accepting this truth was progress. Still, as she got out of the pool, her competitive streak niggled at the edge of her encouragements. The desire to jump back in, to improve her time, was only dampened by a dull throb down her sciatic nerve. Sam quickly showered off the salt water. She dried herself with a towel, her wrinkled fingers catching on the Egyptian cotton. She examined the furrows in her fingertips, her body's response to being submerged for so long. She kept on her prescription goggles as she rode up in the elevator. At the lobby floor, an older man got on, newspaper under one arm, wet umbrella in his hand.
He chuckled when he saw Sam. A beautiful mermaid. She tried to match his ebullient grin. They talked about the bad weather, that a storm working its way up the coast was expected to bring even heavier rains to New York by the afternoon. Almost June, he said, as if the month had somehow sneaked up on him. Sam felt caught a bit unawares herself. She could not believe that only 3 weeks had passed since she had left Pikeville. Her life had easily gone back to normal since then. Her schedule was the same. She saw the same people at work, conducted the same meetings and conference calls, studied the same sanitary storage bin schematics in preparation for trial. And yet, everything felt different. Fuller. Richer. Even doing something as mundane as getting out of bed came with a sense of lightness that had eluded her since, well, if she was being honest, since she had woken up in the hospital 28 years ago. The elevator bell dinged. They had reached the old man's floor. Happy swimming, beautiful mermaid. He waved his paper in the air. Sam watched him walk down the hall. He had a jaunty step that reminded her of Rusty, especially when he began to whistle, then loudly jangled his keys to the beat. As the elevator doors closed, Sam whispered, "Exit pursued by a bear." The wavy chrome that lined the doors showed a woman in ridiculous goggles, smiling to herself. Slim build, black one-piece suit. She ran her fingers through her short, gray hair to help it dry. Her finger caught the edge of the scar where the bullet had entered her brain. She seldom thought of that day anymore. Instead, she thought of Anton. She thought of Rusty. She thought of Charlie and Ben. The elevator doors opened. Dark clouds showed through the floor-to-ceiling windows that lined her penthouse apartment. Sam heard car horns and cranes and the usual din of activity muffled behind the triple-paned glass. She walked to the kitchen, turning on lights as she went. She exchanged her goggles for her glasses. She put out food for Fosco. She filled the kettle. She prepared her tea infuser, mug, and spoon. But before boiling the water, she went to the yoga mat in her living room. Sam took off her glasses. She ran through her stretches too quickly. She was anxious to start her day. She tried to meditate, but she found herself unable to clear her mind. Fosco, finished with his breakfast, took advantage of the break in routine. He dolphined his head into her arm until she gave in. Sam scratched underneath his chin, listening to his soothing purrs, and wondered, as she often did, whether she should adopt another cat. Fosco nipped at her hand, indicating he'd had enough. She watched him saunter off, then fall onto his side in front of the windows. Sam put on her glasses. She returned to the kitchen and turned on the kettle. Rain slanted outside the windows, saturating the lower end of Manhattan. She closed her eyes and listened to the tinny splatter of thousands of raindrops hitting the glass. When she opened her eyes again, she saw that Fosco was staring out the windows, too. He was curved into a backward C, front legs stretched toward the glass, enjoying the heat coming up from the kitchen tiles. They both watched the rain beat down until the kettle gave a low whistle. Sam poured her mug of tea. She set the egg timer to 3.5 minutes to allow the leaves to steep. She got yogurt from the fridge and mixed in granola with a spoon from the drawer. She took off her regular glasses and put on her reading glasses. Sam turned on her phone. There were several work emails, but she opened the one from Eldrin first. Ben's birthday was next week. Sam had asked her assistant to come up with a clever message that would please her brother-in-law. Eldrin had suggested, "That's the tribble with getting older." "Tribble in paradise. Yesterday, all my tribbles seemed so far away." Sam frowned. She didn't know if tribble was inappropriate or too young for a 44-year-old woman to send to her sister's husband. Sam tapped open her phone's browser to research the word. Charlie's Facebook page was already on the screen. Sam visited her sister's page twice a day because That was the most reliable way to find out what Charlie and Ben were up to, looking at houses together in Atlanta, interviewing for new jobs, trying to find someone who knew whether or not it was advisable to relocate rabbits from the mountains to the city. Instead of searching for Tribble, Sam reloaded Charlie's page. She shook her head at a new photo her sister had posted. Another stray had been found. The mutt was splotched, like a blue tick hound, but with stubby dachshund legs. He was standing in the backyard, knee-deep in grass. One of Charlie's friends, a person going by the dubious handle of I Own a Trailer, had posted a snarky rejoinder about how Charlie's husband needed to mow the grass. Poor Ben. He had spent hours with Charlie excavating Rusty's offices and the main floors of the HP, boxing and donating and listing on eBay various magazines, articles of clothing, and, unbelievably, a prosthetic leg that had sold for $16 to a man in Canada. They had never found the photograph of Gamma. There was the photo, the washed-out, sun-bleached picture that Rusty had let fade into nothing on his desk. But the photograph he had told Sam about, the one that he claimed captured the moment he and Gamma had fallen in love, was nowhere to be found. Not in the safe, not in Rusty's files, not in the cabinets, not anywhere in the downtown office or the HP. Sam and Charlie had finally decided that the mythical image was likely one of Rusty's tall tales, embellished, for the sake of the listener, founded in very little fact. Still, the loss of this phantom photo had opened up an ache inside of Sam. For years she had scoured the academic and scientific world looking for the products of her mother's brilliant mind. The thought had not occurred to her until 3 weeks ago, how foolish she had been to have never once searched for her mother's face. Sam could look in a mirror and see the similarities. She could share memories with Charlie, but except for two dry academic papers, there was no proof that their mother had been a vital, vibrant human being. The NASA postcard they had found in Rusty's safe had given Sam an idea. The Smithsonian, in cooperation with the Johnson Space Center, maintained detailed records of every stage of the space race. Sam had put out feelers for a researcher or a historian to perform a proper investigation into whether or not the archives contained photographs of Gamma. She had already gotten several responses. There seemed to be a renaissance within the STEM fields to acknowledge the long-forgotten contributions of women and minorities to the scientific advancements of mankind. The search would be finding a proverbial needle in the haystack. But Sam felt to the core of her being that a photograph of Gamma existed in NASA's or even Fermilab's records. For the first time in her life, she found herself believing that there was such a thing as fate. What had happened in the kitchen almost 3 decades ago was not the end of it. Sam knew that she was meant to see her mother's face again. All that it would take was money and time. Two things Sam had in abundant supply. The egg timer buzzed. Sam poured milk into her hot tea. She stared out the window, watching the rain pelt the glass. The sky had turned darker. The wind had picked up. Sam could feel the slight shift of the building as it rocked against the coming storm. Oddly, Sam found herself wondering what the weather was like in Pikeville. Rusty would have known. Apparently, he had kept up the weather project that he had started with Charlie. Ben had found piles of forms in the barn where for 28 years, Rusty had almost daily notated wind direction and speed, air pressure, temperature, humidity, and precipitation. They had no idea why Rusty was still tracking the information. The weather station Ben had installed on the tower wirelessly reported the data back to NOAA. Maybe what it boiled down to was that Rusty had been a creature of habit. Sam had always thought she was more like her mother, but at least in this one regard, she was certainly like her father. The daily laps in the pool, the mug of tea, the yogurt and granola. One of Sam's many small regrets was that she had not preserved that last message Rusty had left on her birthday. the boisterous greeting, the weather update, the arcane bit of history, the discordant sign-off. She missed his laughter most of all. He had always been impressed by his own cleverness. Sam was so lost in thought that she did not hear her phone ring. The stuttered vibrations of the device shook her back to the present. She slid the bar across the screen. She put the phone to her ear. "She signed the deal," Charlie said by way of greeting. "I told her we could try to get it knocked down a few more years, but Lucy Alexander's parents have been pushing pretty hard, and the Wilsons just want it over with. So she's at 10 years, minimum security, eligible for monitored parole in 5, if she's on good behavior, which, of course, she will be." Sam had to silently repeat Charlie's words back in her head before she fully understood them. Her sister was talking about Kelly Wilson. Sam had hired a lawyer from Atlanta to help work out a plea deal. With Ken Coyne's abrupt resignation and the recording that Charlie had made of Judith Pinkman being considered tantamount to a deathbed confession, the state prosecutor had been eager to make the Kelly Wilson case go away. Charlie said, "Coyne would have never made that deal." "I bet I could have talked him into it." Charlie laughed appreciatively. "Are you ever going to tell me how you got him to quit?" "It's an interesting story," Sam said, but did not tell the story. Charlie still refused to explain how her nose had been broken, so Sam still refused to explain how she had used Mason's confession to intimidate Coyne into stepping down. Sam said, "Parole in 5 years is a good deal. Kelly will be in her early 20s when she gets out. Her child will be young enough for them to bond with each other." "It rankles," Charlie said, and Sam knew she did not mean Kelly Wilson or her unborn child, or even Ken Coyne. She was talking about Mason Huckabee. The FBI had done a full court press against Mason for lying to a federal agent, tampering with evidence, obstruction of justice, and accessory to a double murder after the fact. Despite his voluntary confession to the Pikeville police, Mason Huckabee had, unsurprisingly, hired a really good, really expensive lawyer who'd pled him down to 6 years without a chance of parole. The Atlanta federal pen was not an easy place to serve time, but over the last few weeks, both Charlie and Sam had found themselves wondering if they should follow through on Sam's threat to release Mason's written confession. Sam said what she always said. "It's good for us to let this go, Charlie. Dad would not have wanted us to tie up our lives for the next 5, 10, 20 years hounding Mason Huckabee through the criminal justice system. We need to move on with our lives." "I know," Charlie admitted, but with obvious reluctance.
"It just pisses me off that he only got one more year than Kelly. I guess that's a lesson about lying to a federal agent. But you know, we could always go after him before his release. Who knows where we'll be in 6 years? There's no statute of limitations on..." "Charlie."
"All right," she said.
"Maybe he'll get shivved in the shower or someone will put glass in his food."
Sam let her sister talk.
"I'm not saying he should be murdered or anything, but, like, he loses a kidney or his stomach is shredded or, hey, better yet, he's forced to shit into a bag for the rest of his life."
She took a quick pause for breath.
"I mean, okay, the living conditions in prisons are deplorable and health care is a joke, and they feed them, basically, rat turds, but aren't you kind of glad that he could get something as stupid as an infected tooth and die a miserable, painful death?"
Sam waited to make sure she was finished. "Once you and Ben are living in Atlanta, starting your new lives, it won't matter as much. That's your revenge. Enjoy your life. Appreciate what you have."
"I know," Charlie repeated. "Be useful, Charlie. That's what Mama wanted."
"I know," she said, sighing out the words for a third time.
"Let's change the subject. Since I'm catching you up on the Pikeville crime report, they had to let Rick Fahey go.
Lucy Alexander's grieving uncle, the man who had more than likely stabbed Rusty." Sam said what Charlie must have known.
"Absent a confession, they have no proof against him."
"I keep telling myself that Dad saw him that night, and that he knew it was Fahey, but he decided to let it go. So we should let it go,"
Sam chose not to patronize her sister with Rusty's line about the value in forgiveness.
Isn't this exactly what you said you wanted to do? Learn to let things go?
Yeah, well, I thought you were learning not to be a pain in my ass.
Sam smiled. I want to send you a check for cleaning.
Stop. Charlie was too stubborn to take Sam's money.
Look, we were thinking of taking a vacation before we start our new jobs. Swing down to Florida for a few days to make sure Lenora's settling in. Then maybe fly up to see you.
Sam felt her smile strain at her cheeks.
You won't accept my money, but you'll accept free room and board?
Exactly.
I'd like that.
Sam looked around her apartment. Suddenly, it felt too sterile. She needed to buy things like pillows and hang some artwork and maybe add some color before Charlie got here. She wanted her sister to know that she had made herself a home.
Charlie said, "Okay, I've got to go stew and complain about this to Ben until I wear myself out. Check your email. We found something crazy in the basement."
Sam cringed. The basement had been the bachelor farmer's domain.
"Is this another weird thing that's going to freak me out?"
"Check your email."
"I just checked it." "Check it again, but when we're off the phone. I can look while we're..."
Charlie had hung up. Sam rolled her eyes. There was a downside to having her little sister back in her life. She clicked the home button on her phone. She opened her email. She dragged down the screen with her thumb. The circle spun as the emails reloaded. Nothing new appeared at the top. Sam reloaded the emails again. Still nothing. She took off her glasses. She rubbed her eyes. She ran through all the troubling bachelor farmer surprises they had already found in the basement. Assorted lingerie, various shoes, but only left ones, and a clock of a naked woman that had a perverted Tweety Bird effect. Fosco jumped onto the counter. He sniffed the empty bowl of yogurt, clearly disappointed. Sam scratched his ears. He started to purr. Her phone chirped. Charlie's email had finally arrived. Sam skimmed the listing. "This message has no content."
"Charlie," she mumbled.
Sam opened the email, mentally preparing a wry response, only to find that the message was not empty. A file was attached at the bottom. "Tap to download." Sam's thumb hovered over the icon. The file name was above her nail. Instead of tapping the screen, she put the phone down on the counter. She leaned over, pressing her forehead to the cold marble. Her eyes closed, her hands clasped together in her lap. She slowly breathed in, filling her lungs, before she breathed out again. She listened to the pelting rain. She waited for the butterflies in her stomach to float away. Fosco nudged her cheek. He purred exuberantly. Sam took another deep breath. She sat back up. She scratched Fosco's ears until he'd had enough and jumped down. She put on her glasses. She picked up her phone. She looked at the email. The name of the file. Gamma.jpg. If Charlie had been Rusty's creature, Sam had felt herself entirely Gamma's own. As a child, Sam had spent so many hours watching her mother, studying her, wanting to be like her, to be interesting, to be smart, to be good, to be right. But after Gamma's death, whenever Sam tried to summon her mother's face, she found herself unable to fill in the corresponding expressions. A smile, a look of surprise, a look of puzzlement, of dubiousness, of curiosity, of encouragement, of delight. Until now. Sam tapped the file. She watched the image load onto her phone. She covered her mouth with her hand. She did nothing to stop her tears. Charlie had found the photograph. Not the photo, but the mythical photograph from Rusty's love story. Sam stared at the image for minutes, for hours, for as long as it took to make her memories become whole.
As Rusty had described, Gamma was standing in a field. The red picnic blanket was on the ground. In the distance, there was an old weather tower. Wood, not like the metal tower back home. Gamma's body was turned toward the camera. Her hands rested on her slim hips. One of her legs, admittedly beautiful, was bent at the knee. She was clearly trying not to give Rusty the satisfaction of laughing at something foolish she had said. An eyebrow was raised. Her white teeth showed. Freckles dotted her pale cheeks. She had a slight dimple in her chin. Sam could not deny her father's assessment of the critical moment that had been captured on film. The vivid blue of Gamma's eyes undoubtedly showed a woman falling in love. But there was something else. A set to her mouth, an awareness of the coming challenges, a willingness to learn, a hope for convention, for children, for family, for a full, useful life. Sam knew that this was exactly how Gamma would have wanted to be remembered. Head straight, shoulders back, teeth ground, forever stalking joy. This concludes the reading of The Good Daughter, a novel, by Karen Slaughter. Copyright 2017 by Karen Slaughter. This book was read by Kathleen Early. This unabridged recording was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.